This is The Think Tank, talking about the major economic, political, and social issues of the week on The Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3, KTAR. Here's Dr. Mike O'Neill and Mike Russell.
Now we're back. Can you believe that? And what a week to come back, by the way, Doc. It's been wild.
Some of the most monumental stupidity that I could ever imagine.
Glorious.
Let's look at what happened.
All right.
First of all, because some people think the government spends too much, two things happen. One is we indiscriminately cut down the whole government, not just the stuff that people think is wasteful. And number two, we threaten not to pay our bills on money that had already been spent.
Okay.
So first of all, government shutdown. Let's look at the end result of that. We think government is wasteful, so what we end up doing is giving the vast majority of federal government employees a three-week paid vacation, not even permitted to do any work. I'm telling you, the government employees with laptops, where they shut down their internet, they shut off their cell phones, so even when they come back to work, and by the way, 3 weeks fully paid for that, which to a budget hawk ought to drive you crazy. You come back, what are you going to find? You're going to find 1,000 emails unanswered and dysfunction that'll continue probably for weeks or months. The other thing that we have is think of the cost. You don't just walk out the door and shut the door. If you know you're going to shut down, there's work that you have to do in preparation. There's stuff you have to do on the way back up. Huge cost up. One estimate I've seen already, $25 billion. But number two, and this may even have been worse, the debt limit. The debt limit has nothing to do with what we spend. This is not like telling you having an argument with your spouse about how well we're spending too much. This is about we already spent the money and the bills come in and are you going to pay the MasterCard or not? And if you even threaten not to pay it, what happens? Our costs go up because right now the federal government has very, very low interest rates because we have been perceived as the safest place to put your money in a crisis. And so
have been.
Yes, that's the whole point.
Right.
Is this is at risk. And particularly this happened in the crash of 07, 09. The world economy is crashing and people are looking with big, big money, are looking around not to make money. They're looking around to say, where can I put my money and at least have the principal be secure? And where a lot of that money was U.S. federal treasury notes was the safest thing in the world. Now, all of a sudden, if you even throw into question whether or not under some circumstances we might not pay that back, all of a sudden you threaten that. And so that has an impact on your long-term interest rates that you pay, which means that over the next decade probably cost us an incalculable fortune. And you look at other ancillary things like there is a leader, an economic summit in the Pacific Ring, and all of the leaders of the countries on the PAC rim are there to discuss our economic future. And President Obama is the only leader of any country that doesn't attend. What message does that send to a world that's looking around and saying, where do we look to for leadership?
Well, you know me. I say hang a do not disturb sign on the Statue of Liberty and let's take care of our own business. What do you think of that?
That is our business. A lot of our business is in those places. We want export, to places that are vibrant. We want people to invest here. That is home. That is our business.
But when you say the whole government, we talk about the whole government shutdown. We looked at it when we went into the numbers. We're talking 17-20% of government.
First of all,
there were golf courses that were well open and running. There was a lot of stuff that was opening and running. The stuff that was shut down more seemed to be the stuff that hurts than it doesn't.
Well, you can argue. I mean, they didn't. First of all, anything in a uniform seemed to be exempt. So the entire military, the entire border security
except
guard,
a national park uniform.
Yeah, except for that one, because that's just presumably recreation. Now, think about it this way. Overnight, you have to make 100,000 decisions about what's essential and what's not.
But that's already pre-planned. We know what's essential and non-essential.
Well,
we know what's discretionary spending and what's mandatory spending.
Well, which is not necessarily mandatory. Just means that it's not part of the budget. For example, you get Social Security. That's what's called an entitlement. It may or may not be necessary. It's necessary to use. Somebody else may not.
Sure, right.
It's mandated and it's outside of the budget. But the point is that when you have to make a myriad of decisions like that, a lot of them are going to come down. For example, the parks you mentioned, people might say, well, if we have something that parks are nice, but they're not life or death necessary.
Right.
But then you have incidents like on the mall there where you close down the World War II memorial and it looks like, a slap in the face to World War II veterans.
But if we're talking about the stats you were bringing up, these are dire stats to the future of our country. What you just bring up there is it looks like a slap in the face to the veterans. What we're tiptoeing around here, I believe, is the fact that this is all politics.
Absolutely.
This is 100% politics. A lot of people, depends. You watch Fox News, guess what it is? It's the Obama-Reid shutdown. Yep. You watch MSNBC.
Of course.
It's the Republican shutdown, right?
Let me point out about the debt ceiling,
Okay.
There is no other country in the world that has a debt ceiling issue. In every other country, when the legislative body appropriates and the executive spends, the presumption is that you pay for that. We have this additional provision where we say, even though we already spent the money, we have to separately authorize paying, which really makes no sense.
Yeah.
But it's something that we've had historically. It's even questionable whether it's necessary, but we've always done it.
Like me buying a fishing boat and saying, well, worry about what it costs and how to pay for it later.
Yeah, you already bought the boat. The question is whether you're going to pay for it
a little bit down the road.
I think
asinine, though, is that to people like me?
Yes.
To people, just every guy.
And people do confuse that with, should you have bought the boat, which is a separate question.
Who cares?
You already bought
the boat.
It's
already done. Right. Yeah. Who cares? It's already done. So instead of, and where the most embarrassing part of this whole week has been, Doc, is the kicking the can just down the road. Instead of fixing the problem.
And not very far.
Instead of, it wasn't even a kick. It was more of a tap, right?
Yeah.
But it didn't fix anything. It just moved it down the road, and a lot of people got paid off.
And you hope that, yes, I understand there is a massive public works program authorized in, of all places, Kentucky.
Kentucky.
Mitch McConnell is up for re-election, and he may be a flag waver for less government spending, but not this year and not in Kentucky.
$2 billion. That's with a B.
Yeah. Well,
that's a big payday.
That's the grease that runs the wheels, unfortunately, is spend something else.
All right, we're going to get out of the political weeds for a minute here, Doc, if we could. I want to bring in Art Henshaw. He's the director of Lodestar Dispute Resolution Program. Check that out. This guy can talk about, I want to talk about conflict resolution, want to talk about negotiation, how this should have been done. We'll get to that next. You're in the think tank right here on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to the think tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We are here with Art Henshaw. He is an expert in negotiation, an adjunct professor of law at Arizona State University, and deals in what they refer to in the legal business as alternative dispute resolution. Well, we certainly had a set of interesting disputes in Washington. My question to you is, was there any alternative to what we saw, and how would you as an expert go about in mediating or somehow adjudicating that in a way that left us with something other than a closed down government?
Well, I want to first start off by saying that when you said disputes with an S, that's absolutely right. There's a lot of different disputes going on here. And part of the difficulty and part of the what keeps the news people in business is trying to ferret out which dispute we're talking about at which time. But your bigger question is sort of the ultimate question. It's such a big question that we need to take it apart and deal with separate parts of it. And so I see maybe four or five things that come to a head in this negotiation or this negotiation process. First, this is a long-term negotiation. This isn't a negotiation that just started you know, last month, 2 months ago. It actually started, I guess, with the election in 2010. I'm not a political expert, but at least I follow the news.
At least that far, I'd
at say. Least that far of an expert. And so this has been a long-term negotiation over spending and taxes and things along those lines that we've been discussing for some time. Another part of this discussion is leverage. Another part is about setting goals. Another part is about how do you deal with people who are hard bargainers? What do you do in these kinds of situations?
Both sides accuse the other of being very implacable hard bargainers in this one.
As is almost every negotiation that you see out there. So let's start with hard bargaining just because it's the one that's maybe the brightest one that we see here. We have a group of people who say that we were brought to government to do X. Our job is to do this. And you might say that it's to bring Obamacare down. It might be to basically fix everything that's wrong in Washington, those kinds of things.
Certainly the Tea Party was brought in saying, I wasn't brought here to do business as usual.
Exactly. We're here to shake things up. And so you have a party who basically says, how do we shake things up the most? And they pick whatever that issue is, which they did. And they said, okay, this is it. You have to negotiate on our terms in these kinds of situations. And they'll use whatever they can use for leverage. And you'll notice as we talk that all of these theories are sort of intertwined a little bit. But when we stick with hard bargaining, what hard bargainers tend to do is they tend to be very tough on a position. But while they're tough on that position, they try to get the other side to make mistakes, to lose sight of what's important. So you hear a lot of name calling, other things that will take one's eye off the ball.
Can you think of an instance when this happened in this negotiation?
Well, let's see. You know, I didn't follow it maybe as closely as I should have, but I'm sure that if you and I talked for a little bit, we could certainly come up with some.
There was a tactic from the president's side, from the Democrats, that their talking points were clear, their talking points were concise, and they were uniform. Does not matter who you tapped on the shoulder with a D beside their name, they had it nailed. In negotiation, how important is that, whether the argument's right or wrong, whether the talking point works or not, how important is just a unified front in staying on one particular point?
Right. This is a team activity that we're talking about here. We're not talking about individuals. So when you have a team activity, they have to stick with the plan. If you want to use a sports analogy, military analogies, everybody has to know what their job is. If you watch a football game, not everybody has the same job. They all have different jobs, and everybody has to do their job well for the team to succeed. But I want to get back for a second to your point about trying to get somebody to take their eyes off the ball or eyes off the prize, whatever you want to say. And let's use that national park analogy that you were talking about. So, oh my God, these veterans, we're trying to distort the issues here. Mm-hmm. We're trying to say it's Obama's fault because these things are closed. This is terrible. And there was some park ranger, I remember somebody like just getting drilled in the media
Congressman said, you should be ashamed.
Yes.
That was at the memorial, World War II memorial.
All right, so something along these lines. So they're trying to shame other people into doing things. They're trying to embarrass other people. You hear a lot of name-calling when it comes to the president. And so a lot of these kinds of things are trying to shake one party's resolve in some kind of way. I've seen it in legal negotiations time and time again where there gets into name calling and things along these lines or other ways of saying you're not very good. You can use whatever words you want to use.
Yes, but if you insulted our World War II veterans, you're not very good.
You're not very patriotic. Much more important.
Very, very much more important.
And so hard bargaining tactics tend to be these take it or leave it type tactics. And so when we have one group of people who basically says we're here to do X and that's we are here for that and that alone.
Ted Cruz, we're here to close down Obamacare because
okay.
It's an abomination.
All right. So we're here to close down Obamacare. Take it or leave it. That's considered a hard bargaining tactic. Why? Because it leaves bad taste in people's mouths. We tend to think of bargaining as we're going to do some back and forth here, see mm-hmm. what's possible and see if we can't come up with something that works. Something that, deal making, things that most politicians, at least maybe the Washington insiders are very good at. That's how they get there, is because they're typically good at deal making. And so when you have these hard bargainers, one of the things that you need to do is you need to start by thinking of, well, their concerns are legitimate concerns. Let's address them. Let's have a conversation. Let's do some deal making along these lines. And if that doesn't work, then you have to, in response, up the ante. And we saw that happen in this negotiation, because if you take a look at it as a long-term negotiation that started in 2010 or thereabouts, how many times have we pushed on these debt and finance issues and tax issues? 3-4 times, something along those lines. This is all the same negotiation just taking place over many different quarters, for lack of a better term. And so what happens is Obama tends to be more, let's make a deal kind of a politician, it seems to me. Yeah, he's collaborative. He wants to see what can be done. And it didn't work. He got either run roughshod over, his party didn't like
in
it.
In the earlier instance.
Yeah, right. In the earlier.
Well, even then, this instance when he said, I need a clean CR, I need a clean continue, nothing, I'm not even going to talk about it. You give me what I want, and then we'll negotiate. That's a hard bargain, correct?
And right. I think that was a change from his posture.
Yeah, I don't think he wants to do that. I think he would rather sit down with Boehner, have a beer, talk this out, and get it done.
And I agree with that, because what have Obama and Boehner done? Many times they've sat down and almost had this bargain there. In fact, my understanding is that Stephanopoulos had Boehner on his TV show and said something along the lines of, didn't you have a deal worked out? And Boehner said, yeah, we had it. But what was important was Obamacare. And he brought that up.
I think there's one other thing about this, though. And this goes to classic bargaining strategy, which is you got two people at the table. One of them clearly has authority and it's not clear that the other one does. Obama can cut a deal. Boehner can say, well, I agree with that, but I have to go back to my caucus.
Yeah. Yeah.
True.
And this absent third parties, huge. Absent third parties are huge in negotiation. But one of the things, when you get back to these hard bargainers, you can name the game and then renegotiate the rules. And so this is a classic strategy that Obama has used in this particular situation.
Flesh that out in this context. What does that mean?
Okay. So you heard a lot of the word brinksmanship. You heard a lot of taking hostages, those sorts of things. That's a naming the game kind of scenario. And renegotiating the rules in 2011 or so, the last time we had, what was it, the physical cliff at that time, it had a different name. Back then, when that was all over, Obama said, we're not doing this anymore. This kind of thing is done. I'm not playing this game anymore. If you want to talk to me, this is what you've got to do. And the key is, he has the leverage to make it happen. And we can talk about leverage in a little bit.
All right. So what I want to do is I want to talk about the third party. And the third party in this was the shot clock, was the time clock. Time was the third party in this negotiation. I want to talk about how time plays into certain types of negotiation, especially when it comes to deals like we saw this week. Thanks for being with us, folks. We'll be right back with Art Hinshaw. You're in the Think Tank on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to the Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We are here with Art Hinshaw, expert in negotiation, and we've been discussing the recent events in Washington. You mentioned the issue of leverage. It seemed to me that in this negotiation, the president had most of the leverage. The Republicans certainly had the leverage to close down the government by not doing anything, but that inevitably proved to be very unpopular. The president had a simple position, which is get the government operating, then we can talk. Did he have most of the leverage, and how do you think he played with it?
The president did have most of the leverage here, and the leverage comes from a couple of sources. The first one is back when he was a candidate in 2008, that's what he campaigned on, is Obamacare, or at least some kind of health care reform. He got the act passed, the Affordable Care Act passed in 2009 or 2010, whichever it was. Then he was reelected in 2012.
And that was a major issue in the campaign.
That was a major issue in the campaign, then big discussion all about it. And then the Supreme Court basically said, this act is constitutional. It is good law. It doesn't violate the Constitution, even though you still hear people say that it violates the Constitution. And so you have all of these heavy things becoming the new status quo.
It's kind of, I see that as legitimation.
Exactly.
Of his position.
Right. And so leverage comes from who needs to have the deal most. Whatever the deal is, who needs it most? And when we say most here, what we're talking about is status quo versus non-status quo. We have people who were elected who basically came to power and said, we are going to change the status quo. That's our job. This would be the Tea Party group. Our job is to change things in Washington, to shake things up. And they don't have leverage. So what did they try to do? They tried to gain leverage in some kind of way. And it's a smart negotiation tactic. And one of the things that we talked about, or at least touched on a second ago, was time and how time deals with leverage. And so what the Republicans and Boehner were hoping for is that they could switch the leverage by turning off the government. They could switch the leverage by challenging the debt ceiling. And this goes back to our discussion on long-term negotiations, because before, Obama was seen as capitulating on different kinds of issues. And you heard this week a bunch of people saying, oh, we know Obama. He's not going to be able to stand firm.
Because he hasn't in the past.
Because he hasn't in the past, right? You get a reputation. You get a reputation as doing certain things. And so it sounds like what happened here, this calculated risk to change the leverage, to flip it, backfired because what they were counting on was Obama caving, and this time he didn't. And he had signaled all along very clearly he wasn't going to.
But they didn't believe him.
They didn't believe him because he hadn't done it in the past.
It seemed to me there was one other factor in here, which was the support for the Republican Party on this issue crumbled. In fact, a Republican pollster by the name of Bill McInturf said this was one of the most dramatic things I've ever seen in my life, was how rapidly support for the Republican position crashed, not only among Democrats and independents, but also substantially among Republicans.
Well, and I think that this gets us to this behind-the-table negotiation concept. In a political type of negotiation, well, let me rephrase this. In negotiation, you're always bargaining in the shadow of something. I teach at the law school. We bargain in the shadow of law. You know, what's the law say we're going to do in these kinds of situations? In what played out writ large this past couple weeks is bargaining in the shadow of politics. And this behind-the-table negotiation, who's at the table? It's Boehner and Obama. Those are the people who are really at the table here. If they can come up with a deal, then the deal's going to go through.
Well, Obama can speak for his side. Boehner, not as clear.
Right, and that's the behind-the-table negotiation, exactly. So Boehner has to negotiate with his caucus to see if they're willing to do this or that or something else. And so can he bring them along or not? We are very used to seeing speakers of the House being able to bend people to their will. That doesn't work anymore for a number of reasons that we can come up with, but one of them deals with earmarks. We just don't do earmarks like we used to, although you were talking about one that begins with a B in Kentucky. How convenient.
Right.
But we don't do that as much as we used to. And so my sense is that the Speaker of the House just isn't as strong as that seat or that position is that we have traditionally
thought
of.
Boehner is certainly not in the cut of any recent speaker in
right.
terms of relative power. Now, on the other hand, it's also very clear that he got dealt a very difficult hand.
Well, right.
He has a substantial piece of his constituency who view their role not as compromising, but as upsetting the whole apple.
And he's following probably the most powerful speaker we've had. Nancy Pelosi's word is law to the Democrat side in D.C., it's law. What she says goes.
If you look at the vote total on this thing, there was not a single Democrat who strayed.
She said the word specifically, whatever bill you put before me, every Democrat will sign it.
Yep.
And she could say that with certainty.
And Boehner got about one-third of the Republicans to vote for this.
So he's following probably the most powerful speaker we've ever had.
But if you think about it, in addition to the things that you're saying, what's happened here is Boehner has been in this negotiation with his caucus and what can he do, what can he not do. And it seems to me that one of the things in this negotiation that he said is, I'll go to the mat for you on this. I'll go all the way. I'll go as far as we can go. And if X happens, we're going to go this way. And if Y happens, we're going to go that way. And maybe that was based on the political opinion polls or whatever that you just brought up. And clearly, you know, the politics of this just took a nosedive, like you said. And ultimately, you know, Boehner all along has been saying, we're not going to default. We're not going to default. So maybe he was signaling something to those investors, to other countries, et cetera.
That but giving up leverage at the same time, wasn't he? Yeah. He was handing over his leverage.
But the investor class was ready to completely freak out if anybody in power had intimated that default was even an option.
Right. And so we see this within the Republican Party in the House, that this behind-the-table negotiation is happening with Boehner. Is Boehner going to retain his speakership or not? You know, there's been a lot of question of whether or not he's going to be going down as speaker. But it seems to me that he probably struck a deal saying, if I go all the way to the mat for you on this—
But not to the point of default.
But not to the point of default, then you need to support me. And on some of the interviews that I've heard this morning, some of the Tea Party leaders have said, yeah, he's stronger than ever and things along those lines. So from an individual standpoint for Boehner's power, it looks like he has probably done himself a favor.
But from a team standpoint, he is standing oh from the Republicans after the vote. I mean, from a team, we talked about a team sport.
Well, exactly.
He looks like he's got his team behind him.
And so now the question will be, what's next? You were talking about kicking the can down the road, and there was a little bit of disappointment along those lines. But it makes sense to me from a negotiation standpoint to kick this can down the road because this was a really big issue. This was huge. And we've had all along this idea of we can't talk about anything until we get this first thing taken care of. So maybe this first thing is now taken care of. And now we can talk about the rest and filter down into some of the issues of are we going to talk about this? Are we going to talk about that? You know, I was talking before about how Obama likes to be a deal maker. I think Boehner's the same way based on his background and some of the things that I've read about him. Yep. And so it wouldn't surprise me if we got this grand bargain, this conversation about this comes back up.
That they got very close to at least once in the past.
Yeah. So it wouldn't surprise me at all.
The question is whether I think the naysayers in the right wing of the Republican Party are going to permit it. My guess is that they won't have the stomach for brinksmanship again.
Real quick, 15 seconds. Letter grade each side, Republicans, Democrat, this week.
This week, I would say Democrats, A. I would say Republicans, D as in
D.
Dog.
Wow.
D as in
D.
Dog.
Yeah. All right.
Well, they almost failed.
And we definitely want to thank you for stopping by. This is Art Hinshaw. He's director of the Lodestar Dispute Resolution Program, an expert on all things negotiation. Thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks. This was great. A good time. Thank you so much.
Hey, when we come back, as we always do, we're going to tie a bow around this thing. Doc and I will hash it out. We'll get down to the meat and potatoes of what went down this week with the debt ceiling and the government shutdown. Thanks for being with us, folks. It's News Talk 92.3
KTAR. You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
And we stole him from the Lodestar Dispute Resolution Program, Art Hinshaw. We thank him for stopping by. Doc, this is a very important week, I think, both politically and financially for our country. The obvious reasons are our debt ceiling financially, but I want to dig in. I want to dig into the politics side of it.
I see three long-term repercussions of this.
What are they?
The first is that the Republicans took a really bad hit. It's a long ways to the next election, so
right.
You can't say for sure. But in the House of Representatives, which the Democrats got 1.5 million more votes in the last election than the Republicans, but redistricting has worked such that that wasn't remotely close enough to taking the House. Up until this point, it has been regarded as completely unreachable. The best estimate is they need about a 5 million vote margin to capture the House. At the end of this whole fiasco, for the very first time, some people are discussing the fact that retaking the House from
not going to happen
might be
no
possible.
Way. No way.
I wouldn't take an even money bet.
Let me tell you
what. I won't take an even money bet.
I would give you seats. I would spot you seats on that bet. And here's the reason why. Have we heard anything about Syria this week? Nope. Next week? Nope. Did we hear about it last week? Nope. We have such, as an American people, as a voting population, we have such a short-term memory. And this got diluted so quickly
I noted that in my caveat already. Remember?
Right,
but it's a long time.
A long time.
This wasn't even thinkable until a month ago.
Oh, it was. We've had, but here's the deal, though. We're now realizing, as citizens, we're realizing the last six financial crises, even with sequestration, the fiscal cliff, right?
Yep.
Now we debt ceiling. How much less money are we spending today than we did?
A minor hit from the sequestration.
Yeah. That was a cut on increased spending. We're still spending more today than we did before all six of these last financial crises. That's why we're looking at these folks. Well, at least the ones that aren't on the left and the right fringe. We're looking at these politicians and thinking, look, you guys are crazy.
Let me give you my other 2 points. Then we
okay.
Can
oh, okay.
Point number two. I'm not sure that the Republicans will have the stomach for this kind of brinksmanship in January. We kicked the can down the road just a little bit, but I would be really surprised if the Republicans would, at this point, be willing to threaten either the shutdown of the government or certainly the debt limit. I think that's probably off the table. They took a bad enough hit. So, in effect, in this, from the perspective of this negotiation, they just had a major club taken away. The third interesting consequence of all this is the persona of Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz made himself an overnight hero with the Tea Party. My guess is if you did a survey of Republican primary voters for president next time, he probably heads the list. But I will also bet you that in the cloakroom of the Republican caucus of the United States Senate, he is the most unpopular man in the room. Our own Senator John McCain recently referred to him as a wacko bird. He retreated from that because that's very unsenatorial talk. But that was like that was a classic political gaffe. That's when you get caught saying in public something that you really believe.
Tony, I want you to mark the calendar, please, because I'm actually going with Dr. O'Neill on one thing. I am. The last point, Ted Cruz, you and I. Walk in lockstep. You and I finally agree on something.
Well, I'm not saying it's good. Again, short term. Not sure it's going to last. But right now, he is the hero of the kind of person who comes out to vote in the Republican
primaries.
Let
me give you three names that not a lot of people knew 4 months ago. Let's say 6 months ago, right? Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, and Wendy Davis, right?
Yep.
What did all three of them do?
They all
filibustered, right?
Yeah.
And then following, what are they setting up for? Higher office.
Yeah.
And
she will not win.
She will not win.
She will not. She will get a lot of national money.
She'll get all kinds of awesome, but she's not going to win.
She may have a commentator job at NBC in her future at some
MSNBC,
point.
MSNBC, yes.
Cruz, huge personal hit. But in terms of his capacity to do deals as a senator or whatever.
Toast in the primaries.
Yeah.
He'll run. He'll run for sure.
Yep.
Toast in the primaries. That is not a horse to bet on.
And he'll get a lot of attention.
Right.
But this will be the classic fight for the soul of the Republican Party.
But here's where he holds power, though, especially you go to those primaries.
Yep.
Here's where he holds the power. Because he's bringing the entire right fringe with him.
And the energy.
He has it.
He has the energy.
So he'll bring those into the election.
Yep.
He knows he's not going to compete in the primary. So what he is going to do is now he's going to be the golden ticket for the ones that do have a shot in the primaries to get his backing.
Could be.
To have him as a VP. He is in a great position right now. He has played this whole process like a fiddle, but it's not going to work.
He's the classic Veep choice. Somebody brings something to the ticket.
Yep, absolutely.
And maybe it's a little too scary to be at the top of the ticket, but they can energize the troops.
Now I'll go back to the second point that y'all want to talk about. That we'll work back to the House here momentarily. But you said the Republicans aren't going to have the pair to come with this kind of arsenal at the next negotiation
they
of the debt
took
ceiling.
Such a public opinion hit.
They took a public
time.
Opinion hit.
A
understand.
Big one. A under, big one.
But understand this. Understand this. When the president speaks, their opposition, it's on every network and on every radio station. Boehner gives the same press conference same day, not even covered by Fox. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that side has the bully pulpit. They've got the megaphone. They have the loudest voice.
The president.
They know
speak.
They have to. They know they have to come with this type of an arsenal again if they even want to be taken seriously.
Well, the president can get on and say, "Listen, we should negotiate fairly. We should deal with these issues." But don't close down the government. Don't threaten the full
faith and credit. But going back to negotiation that we were talking about earlier, that to me is probably the dumbest thing I've heard of. When you have a president of the United States saying, give me everything I want, get rid of all of your leverage, and then we'll negotiate. Yeah. Are you hearing about meetings right now, negotiation between the president, the White House, and the Republicans? No. They've lost all their leverage. It's gone.
As our guest pointed out, the response to that was to say, wait a minute, no, this is illegitimate to shut down the government, to threaten the full faith and credit. The issue, and I think it's the one thing that the president hasn't dealt with very well at all, the Republicans have made a lot of hay on the issue of, quote, cut spending. And every person in the whole country
can sit there. But then take a $2 billion check.
Well, everybody in the country can sit and see something that they've seen in government that strikes them as wasteful. But in almost no instance, when these people are saying cut spending, do they get specific, other than the one thing that's not going to happen, which is cut Obamacare. He's not going to cut out the main achievement. I think the power of the president to the Republicans is to say, you want to cut spending, let's talk about it, but tell us where. Make us a specific proposal. You move it to that, and then it gets a whole lot harder, because we all, in the abstract, the three, four of us, all of us in this room could agree we want to cut something in government spending.
Yes.
It's not clear that we would name the same items.
I'm going to start with a place in Kentucky. They just got awarded $2.2 billion.
Try to get that one through the Senate.
There. Oh, my gosh. It is. And here's the problem I see, Doc. And from a public opinion standpoint, I really value your feedback on this. I view this isn't going to issue. We talk about 2010 election. 2014 elections and, the 2016 election. Nothing's going to happen. The reason why is because of our incumbent reelection rate. And that is because each of us, I'm painting with a very broad brush, but our guy isn't. Everyone else is corrupt. Our guy isn't. Our guy, I voted for him. You bet. He's doing the right kinds of things, unless you do something stupid like an O'Connell.
Our Congress is elected from districts that are inherently very, very different, and the constituents in those districts do not themselves agree with one another across districts. Most congressmen are a reasonable reflection of their district, with a caveat, which is that the primary system tends to amplify the extremes.
Right. But those extremes are the ones that are voting.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And voting in primaries, which is different from voting in November.
That's a very good call.
So in both parties, the more extreme factions control. And that's why, by the way, the Tea Party guys that have been driving this particular debate, they are not concerned about getting beat by a Democrat. Their only concern is getting beat in a primary by somebody more extreme than them. And so they have almost no incentive to negotiate or move towards the center on an issue.
30 seconds. Where do we go?
Oh, I think you're right. We go towards more of the same. And I think our guest really pointed out this is not properly seen as a 2-month or a 3-month. This is a multi-year, perhaps multi-decade long extended process where we are dealing with the issue of how much government do we want and where do we want it. And there are fundamental disagreements amongst people in this country that are not easily resolved. We may have fatigue about shutting the government, but we sure as heck didn't solve anything this week. We nudged the can down the road just a little.
And that always is my partner in crime, Dr. Mike O'Neill. You can find him at MikeO'Neill.org for blogs, articles, op-eds, videos. Hey, you want to get some podcasts of the Think Tank? Give them away as stocking stuffers. Oh, they're going to make a great gift, I promise. You can find O'NeillResearch.com for marketing and public opinion research. We want to thank our special guest, Art Hinshaw, the director of the Lodestar Dispute Resolution Program. It's been a very, very wild week. We're glad you let us help you decompress a little bit on your Sunday. Have a great week. Thanks for being with us. On behalf of Mike O'Neill, Mike Russell, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.